Three, two, one. Welcome to the podcast where we are taking the fight to the enemy. This enemy is invisible, but still lurks at our doorstep. It has wreaked havoc on our families, causing them to crumble by attacking the heart of true masculinity. In the runes that are left behind, there are many men, women, and children that are injured, lost, confused, and frustrated, wandering aimlessly through life. As men, we are not called to sit by the wayside and do nothing while the enemy grows its armies and destroys the things we love most. We are called to stand and fight. Join us as we rally with other men to navigate the complexities of manhood and explore the qualities that make a man humble, tough, and devoted. Get ready to take the fight to the enemy by facing your inner coward and embracing your calling as a man. This is the Few Good Men's podcast. Episode 4 with Jameson Roberts and me, Jake Dipple. Today, we are joined by the one and only Wesley Rhodes. Wesley Rhodes is a father of twins, a National Guard veteran, helicopter pilot, fixed wing pilot, entrepreneur, podcaster, professional dad jokester, which we're going to have to mix in a little bit here, varsity athlete, car salesman, wholesale lobster. I don't really know what that means, but I'm sure we're going to get into that. And van life. Wesley, how you doing, my man?
I'm good. How are you guys?
Doing good. Doing good, Wesley. Yeah, some of the stuff I didn't realize that you did. Like, I'm not sure what wholesale lobster or any of that, but I'm sure you'll enlighten us on what that is, dude.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we'll,
it was a wild time.
Do what?
It was a wild time, to say the least.
It sounds like it. Between van life and like wholesale lobster, it sounds,
that's right.
I feel like every time I talk to you, you've always got your hands like in something new. Yeah,
that's accurate.
And now your hands are full with twins, and I could not imagine that. All right, so
I don't know it any other way. So,
so we're gonna get rolling. We're going to do something today. It's called immediate action drill. And if you're familiar with the military, those of you listening, immediate action drill is basically when something goes south or something happens, there's a protocol that you do in order to get things back in action. So like if your weapon jams, there's an immediate action that you perform, like a tap rack bang, to get the weapon back in the fight. So this is a similar thing, except for what we're going to do is name our top three action movies, or mainly action movies that you've seen. So your top three, you've got 30 seconds to do it. As soon as you're done, it'll go to the next person. All right. So again, top three of the manliest action movies you've seen. All right. Jake, we'll start with you.
Oh my goodness.
And I'll have a timer set, so it'll be quick. Wesley, we'll put you last since you're a guest today.
All right, am I ready to go?
Three, two, one, begin.
Number one is no-brainer, Sound of Freedom. That's that new movie where that guy takes on all the sex traffickers. Okay. So that's pretty all legit. Right. I'm going to go James Bond. I'm going to go James Bond just because, okay, I don't know where else to go. And he looks like a man. He dresses in suits and fires things up. Okay. And then I'm going to go, let's go Rudy, the football movie, the Notre Dame guy. Yeah, those are my three.
And three, two, one, time. All right, Wesley. Wait, I'll go next because you're going to last. All right, three, two, one, go. All right, my top three. Okay, 300 for sure. That's going to be number one with the good Spartans. One. I mean, that's pretty manly. I would say Top Gun. No, I'm not going to say Top Gun. I'm going to say, man, I even knew the prompt and I should have.
You Patriot. Wrote the prompt. You ran out of time.
Yeah, but I wanted to make it fair. The Patriot. John Wick.
That's good.
Finished in 32
Patriot's
seconds.
Good. Nice. Patriot's a good one.
Yeah. All right. I finished in 32 seconds, so I technically lost. All right, Wesley. Three, two, one, go.
All right. Top Gun, Maverick, and A Few Good Men.
Oh, my God. That's good. That's
all
good.
Tom Cruise.
No, podcast, a few good, right? A Few Good Men is
It's an Italian movie. What's his name? It's a good
anyway.
Movie. Yeah. Whatever it is, it's a good movie.
Yeah. Well, whoever's listening, they can Google it or tell us later in the comments. All right. So yeah, we'll go ahead and dive into it. So on this podcast, our focus is just to explore the heart of masculinity and mainly to learn from others what masculinity looks like in other areas of life and what it looks like in the real world. Our goal in this episode, Wesley, is to dive into your story and learn from some of your experiences and maybe failures of what it means to be a good man and maybe things that you want to tell other people that you wish you would have heard early on in your life. We know that the world tells us a lot of things that aren't true regarding masculinity and that oftentimes true masculinity is considered pretty toxic nowadays in a lot of ways. If you're passionate about fatherhood, flying aircrafts, the military, and entrepreneurship, I'm sure you're going to enjoy everything that we have in this episode as we dive into it with Wesley Rhodes. So Wesley, let's start off like, where did you grow up and what's your background? As far as where you grew up, when you were born, and things like that.
Yeah, so I was born in the 90s in Atlanta, Georgia, and then moved from there to Huntington, West Virginia, and then grew up there more or less until I was 18, and then went to North Carolina.
Man, so how long you lived in North Carolina?
Off and on for 5 years.
Gotcha.
Where'd you go to high school, Wesley?
I went to Cabell Midland High School in Ona, West Virginia.
What kind of things did you do in high school? Like what were you involved in?
I was always into like a little bit off-centered stuff. So for me, I was big into cycling, mountain biking, road biking, snow skiing, water skiing, hiking, climbing, those types of things. Whereas my school that I went to is very, you know, traditional football, soccer, baseball, that type of thing.
Gotcha. So you were more like an outdoorsman during your high school years rather than on the football field.
Yeah, for sure. 100%.
Did you have race?
Any crazy experiences on camping trips or outdoors in general?
Man, outdoors in general. I mean, I spent a bulk of my time on the bike and went to school on a cycling scholarship and was one of the few varsity teams in the country for on the collegiate level. And so I got a lot of cycling stories. And as far as like outdoor stories, I can think of a few, but nothing really I think noteworthy enough to share on the podcast here.
Yeah, save your dignity, man.
But yeah, I mean, and then I have a super long one for cycling, so if you guys want to hear it, I'll send it, but it's a long one, so buckle up.
Yeah, man, go for it.
All right, so there I was. anyway, in our local area, we did a fast ride every Tuesday night on the road bikes. And so this particular Tuesday, it was August of 2008, I believe. A buddy of mine, Tony, and myself, the day before had done 100 miles on the bike. And so both of us were just gassed for this fast ride. And so we let the group go ahead of us. And we would leave the shop in West Virginia, cross the bridge into Ohio. And then we go up into the hills in Ohio and then follow the river back to the bridge to West Virginia. And on the ride next to the river back to the bridge, it's several miles long. You know, Tony and I had let the rest of the group go ahead of us. And anyway, Tony, a little bit of background on him. You know, he's born and raised in West Virginia. he was in his late 30s at the time, probably 6'3", just a phenomenal athlete for sure. And then kind of a mentor figure to me, and I was 16 at the time. And anyway, whenever we'd ride, he'd, you know, share life stories and all that. But anyway, we're riding on this road back to the bridge to West Virginia, and him and I are just side by side and chatting and whatnot. And we pass by this library, and there's a police car sitting there, and didn't think anything about it. We keep riding, and anyway, I don't know, maybe somewhere between 10 and 30 seconds later, there's a car behind us. And so in cycling, you yell car back to let the other guy know there's a car coming from behind, and you get a single file to let that car pass. So we did that. And then when that car came up next to us, it was that police car. And anyway, he rolled up next to Tony, rolled his window down, got very, very close to us. And there's it's just car, us, and then edge of road. There's nothing over there. And he yells out the window at Tony some explicit choice words. And anyway, he basically told us we weren't allowed to be on the road, and Tony told him that in fact we were, and then he proceeded to then try to push us off the road with his car. And so Tony stands up, sprints, and gets in front of the car, and I brake, go behind the car, and the car goes off the side of the road and then comes back up onto the road, and then he's chasing after Tony. I'm right behind, and then all of a sudden he just locks his brakes up, like four wheel skids to a stop. And then I have to go around him to the left because he's on the very side of the road. And as I'm coming around the left side of the car, the door opens up, and this police officer jumps out of his car and goes to push me off my bike. You know, it's like, and anyway, what had happened though is he hadn't got his arm out of the seatbelt. So as he jumps out of the car and he's trying to like push me, his seatbelt locks up around his left arm, and he trips and falls.
Oh,
yeah. So I catch up with Tony, and I'm like, "Hey, man, this isn't good." And Tony tells me, he's like, "Man, we haven't done anything wrong. Just hang with me." I'm like, "Okay." And so, with Tony, and the police officer gets back in his car and turns on his lights and sirens at this point and yells over the PA system, y'all are under arrest. And anyway, then he passes us doing a high rate of speed, and we're on a 25 mile an hour road at this point, and he passes us at a high rate of speed, goes up maybe 200-250 yards, and he pulls his car across the road. Now we're probably an eighth of a mile from the bridge to West Virginia. We're not like running for the bridge or anything. But anyway, so he pulls his car across the road, blocks it, gets out, and pulls his firearm on us and says, "Stop or I'll shoot." And so we stopped, and we got off the road into this little mom and pop used car dealership across from like a little gas station, like community bank kind of feel, you know, two lane road, just like a small little city. Or not even a city, be a town. And anyway, so we stop, get into this little used car parking lot, and the police, he's just yelling at Tony, like top of his lungs yelling at Tony, you're under arrest, blah blah blah, just like going off. And Tony's like, he's yelling back at him, he's like, man, we ain't done nothing wrong, and like just back and forth. And within 30 seconds, there's five police cars on the scene.
Oh my goodness.
This is no joke. Five cars on the scene. And anyway, Tony and the first guy are yelling back and forth. And then that police officer pulls his taser and tases Tony. He shoots him with the taser, right? and it doesn't work, right? I guess both barbs have to go into the skin, and it didn't. One of them connected, the other missed. So now, like, the police officer is just mad, and he pulls out his ass baton, and he's just wailing on Tony over the head with it. And Tony's blocking it with his bike. Tony's got like a, at the time, probably $8,000-$9,000, you know, race road bike, and just carbon fibers just cracking, and it's a gnarly situation. And I'm like, okay, this is not going well. So I pull my phone out, an old Motorola Razr, and I dial my mom. And as I'm doing that, another police comes up behind Tony, and he tases him in the back. This one works. Tony goes straight up onto his toes and falls like a tree. And thank goodness he's wearing his helmet, because, like, he fell straight on his face.
Oh, my goodness. And
anyway, they put him in handcuffs. And I get through to my mom, and I get the word mom out. And then the first police officer comes up from behind me, and he grabs the phone out of my hands, breaks it in half, throws it on the ground, and says, "Get on your face," with some other explicit words mixed in there. And so I'm still straddling the bike. So I go and get off the bike. And as I'm putting the bike down on the ground, he picks me up from behind the backs of my arms, and, like, just puts his knee in my back, picks me up off the ground, and then puts me in handcuffs. And I'm looking across the parking lot at Tony, and Tony's, like, still, he's mad, right? Yeah. Tony's mad that this has happened. He's in handcuffs, and they still have a taser attached to him. And every time Tony's yelling out something, like, he's like, "I'm going to sue you." And every time he says anything, they're just zapping him. Like, he's in handcuffs on the ground, and they're just zapping him. If I had estimated, it'd probably been like 6 to 12 times that they hit him. With it.
That is awful.
So anyway, they pick him up and put him in a police car and take him off. And they leave his bike sitting there on the side of the road. And then there's a lady cop from the city, I believe, that she comes over to me and picks me up, puts me in her car. And they left my bike on the side of the road as well. And anyway, we're driving along, and I'm like, "Where are we going?" She says, "Jail." And I'm like, "I can't go to jail. My parents are going to kill me. I'm only 16. She's like, "What'd you say?" I said, "My parents are going to kill me." And she's like, "No, how old are you?" And I was like, 16. She calls over the radio after that. She's like, I have detained a minor.
Holy and, cow.
I take them, and they're like, long pause, take them to the station. So she takes me to the police station. And anyway, I get to call my parents there, and they're in Kentucky at the time, I guess, with my sisters doing like a horse show type thing. And anyway, they hustled back, because they got there within like an hour and 15 minutes, and it's normally like 2 hours. So dad must have been ripping. But anyway, they show up, and I tell them the whole story again. And then the first police officer shows up. And now, by this point, probably like 2.5 hours has elapsed since the whole thing went down. And when he shows up, like, he's still like red in the face, sweating. And you could tell he's just, adrenaline's kicking. He's mad.
Yeah.
And he comes in, and he's like yelling at my parents, and he's like, "Let me tell you a real story." And he takes them outside the police station, just like one of those old metal buildings, and you could just hear him like screaming at my parents. And apparently the story that he told them was that he was on the way to a burglary, and we weren't letting him get around to pass. And then you hear my mom cut him off, and apparently she said, "You mean to tell me you couldn't get around two cyclists in wearing spandex to get to a burglary?" She's like, "This makes absolutely zero sense. Oh, we're going to have a lawyer tonight." And then he changes his story. And he's like, "Well, no, I was going to get their statements." And then she comes in, and she's like, "Wes, get your stuff. We're leaving." And then he says, you can't leave. And then they're like, why not? And he said, well, I arrested him. And then my dad's like, for what? And he says, and this is a direct quote, I don't know, but I have to book him for something.
Wow.
Yeah. And so he sits down with his big black binder. It's like a 4-inch binder. And he's just like looking through it for something to charge me with. And so I ended up getting charged with failure to comply and riding in a pedway, apparently because we crossed the sidewalk to get into the used car lot. And then we'll make a super long story shorter. And it took a year and some change for them to drop all that on me because I had to go in front of a magistrate. Tony's was, they threw the book at Tony, like assaulting a police officer and all that stuff.
Oh, my goodness.
At the end of the day, they crushed the tasers that were used so they couldn't read the memory from them. The police cars on the scene all had cameras, like 360 cameras on them. The hard drives from them were unusable. They think that they took like high power magnets to them. There was a gas station across the street that had a camera facing the lot where this whole thing happened. That footage disappeared. And come to find out the chief of police actually owned that gas station. And then the guy that started this whole thing had several counts of domestic violence on his record. And he'd also ran over a guy off duty in his truck after he had been drinking at a bar across the river in West Virginia and put him in a coma.
Oh my goodness.
As we're like still cops. So anyway, Tony ended up suing him and winning. And then, I did the same thing. But not to the same extent that Tony did, but anyway, yeah, it's crazy times. So, that was kind of my first encounter with the police. And
dude, holy cow. I've never heard this story as long as I've known you.
Biggest fan in the world, to be honest. The ones that I don't interact with, I feel like are doing something worthwhile. But I feel like if I'm having to interact with a police officer, it's for something like trivial or I don't know, just kind of crazy. But anyway, long story short, yeah, that was a fun time.
Holy cow, dude. So I guess I was going to ask, like, your parents, like, were they even mad at you? Like, after this, did they even?
No, not at all. They were super mad when they got there. But then once they interacted with that guy, it was like, this is insanity. Like, this doesn't make any sense. Like, this guy's just a raging hothead. Like, he shouldn't have a badge.
Yeah. Wesley, who was the strict parent growing up? Who were you more frightened of, I guess, is the best way to put it. Mom?
Oh, yeah.
Why's that?
She threw the hammer down.
Man.
I don't know. I feel like because my mom was able to be home a lot, so, you know, if we had to wait till dad got home, like, that was bad too. But like, mom usually dealt with it with the appropriate amount of force quickly.
Do you and Tony still keep up? Like, do y'all still connect? Dude,
yeah.
And I bet that's gonna be a story that will never go away.
Oh yeah, if you talk to him, it'll be, you should probably set aside an hour.
That's funny.
Yeah.
So this pretty much, so you were 16 when this happened, right?
That's right.
Gotcha. So pretty much, what age is that, like freshman year?
Is that
I think it's like freshman, sophomore.
Sophomore, probably.
Gotcha. So, like, as you went through sophomore year and then went into your senior year, what was the next step that you went into?
With the legal proceedings or?
Just in life in general. So, like, you had, obviously, like, you were in high school, you were outdoorsy, and then As you kind of went through your junior and senior year, what was your plans? What were you going to pursue?
I was big into cycling, and I was on a really competitive junior cycling team.
Really?
And we did a couple of big stage races, and one up in Canada, but everything else was in the United States. But yeah, I mean, I spent all my free time on the bike, especially like junior, senior year.
Really? How many hours a week would you say that you put in?
A lot. I don't know. I'd say probably average of like 2.5 hours a day.
Man.
Jeez. Wesley, what separates a really good cyclist from just like an average cyclist? I guess because for running, it's like oxygen capacity and stuff of that nature. Is it output and power just as much as it's like ability to hold oxygen? Or
yeah, so VO2 max is a big one. Yeah, and I think that's what you're getting at with the whole running thing. So yeah, if you have a high VO2 max, then you're genetically predisposed to do really well. I don't have the highest of VO2s, but sprinting was kind of my thing. And because there's a huge advantage, like 30 some percent less drag when you're drafting somebody, there's a lot of like skill and tactics involved with bike racing, where I think in running, you may get, I think, up to like a 5% reduction in drag from drafting, which isn't as significant as it is on the bike. I think, tactically on the road, just being able to think when you're in that oxygen deprived state is big.
So are you riding with a team and things like this to where you're drafting off each other and you're putting your better guy in the back, or?
Yeah. So yeah, if you're doing like a lead out train, that type of thing, but there's different tactics. Sometimes you'll send a fast guy out that like the particular race doesn't really suit his strong suit, but you can like send him off the front to make all the other teams just like gas themselves out to try to chase him down while your guys like sit in and, just draft the whole way so they stay fresh. So you kind of send out the rabbit, so to speak. And then on like mountain biking and stuff like that, you're just practicing skills and that type of thing is really helpful. And then also having good coaches and mentors to like help you learn instead of just like trying to figure it all out on yourself. That can really help you jumpstart things. But I think on the roadside, there's a lot of tactics involved that people are not necessarily aware of.
And you said you cycled in college?
Yeah.
Where was that at?
Lees McRae up in the mountains of North Carolina.
And did you, because you went into the military after college, right?
Yeah. Way after.
So were you ROTC in college too, or were you just cycling and that was kind of an afterthought?
Well, I was looking at the Air Force Academy out of high school, but my whole legal proceedings thing kind of messed things up for me on that. And then out of college, joined the Air Force, and then I guess they had a drawdown or something 2 months before I was supposed to go to, or not 2 months, a month before I was supposed to ship out to OTS. They told me the rated position was no longer available. I could go non-rated, which is non-flying, if I wanted to. And I just told them no. So that was that. And then I kind of shifted over to the civilian sector for several years between graduating and then joining the Guard.
So you already knew that you wanted to be a pilot?
Yeah. Yeah.
Gotcha. So what about being a pilot fascinated you or kind of drew you to it?
My grandpa is a pilot. And then it's always just, I feel like it's everybody's dream to be able to fly, right? I mean, it's just such a cool thing. And then when your teachers tell you can't make money, just look it out the window,
Sure enough, that's what you're doing now.
Here.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, so, no, I'm just always interested in it.
Gotcha. So you said you went National Guard. Did you go pilot in the National Guard? Do they have a program like that, or was it just kind of?
I tried to, but then the timing of how everything worked out didn't really end up working out. A lot of training that I did in the Guard happened during like the COVID times, and so all things said, I didn't have a very good experience with the Guard. And I think it's all a matter of like circumstance that is the case, but anyway, yeah, it's good. I have some lifelong friends from it, and
yeah. Gotcha. So as you were kind of leaving high school, going to college, and you still had the issues with like the police incident that you had, as you're like, if you can think back to like your senior year about to step into the career field, what advice would you give to someone that is about to step into the career field as far as choosing their path? How do you recommend that they go about choosing what they want to do?
Yeah, I mean, some people are lucky and they just like know what they want, or their family business that it's just kind of a natural thing for them to get into. And I kind of agree with Mike Rowe on things that you may not end up working in the field that like you're passionate about, but like then once you learn that trade, then you become passionate about it. So I don't know if it's necessarily something that like you need to like figure out what your exact passion is. But I will say for people that are trying to figure out what it is that they want to do, if you're in a school setting that has access to take the ASVAB in school, which is the military's standardized test, they on the one that is administered in this in a high school setting, they have like a skills or a career assessment tool along with the test. And I think it's probably the best career placement test that I've ever seen. However, you can't take it with like the normal ASVAB. Like if you go to a recruiter, it has to be sanctioned through your school in order to take that portion of it. And so like, even if you're not interested in the military, I would take the ASVAB and then just for that career assessment. And then if you just seriously don't know what you want to do, I don't think that just jumping straight into college is necessarily the right call. And if we're talking to, you know, people that are very like hands-on, I think there's a lot of opportunity with the military, whether that be Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, or the Coast Guard. There's a lot of opportunities there. And as a young person, you know, even the National Guard or the Reserves can be a really cool outlet because of being able to join October of your junior year, and then you could start drilling, and then between your junior senior year you go to basic training, and then after your senior year you go to AIT for the Army, and then Air Force would be the same as well. I don't know what they call it in the Air Force, the on the job training or your job training. Yeah. And then your time in the service starts at 17 years old, you know? And then like the Guard, especially, I think it's a great place to network with people and then kind of like figure out where your skills are. But then if we're talking to even younger guys, I think it's good to reach out to your local community and like just try things out and see what you're interested in, you know? I'm a big proponent of the trades, you know, whether it be, you know, HVAC or plumbing, electrical, you know, even being a pilot is a trade. If you're into that kind of thing, there's a clear path for you to go from zero to into one of those trades. And I think that that coupled with, you know, reaching out to some entrepreneurial minded people, you can really set yourself up for success.
Yeah. About how long did it take you to get your pilot license?
So I went to do the helicopter thing, and it's not necessarily as clear of a track as it is for the fixed wing, and it's also extremely expensive. So it took me it only took me about a year to get my commercial license. But I also ended up getting my fixed wing license as well as a private pilot. And then now I'm, you know, commercial, both fixed and rotor. And then I also instruct just in helicopter. But yeah, I mean, all in all, probably like 2 years for the whole process, but started earning money after probably, I don't know, 18 months or 2 years of focusing on flying. But you can, that timeline can be as short as 3 months if you have all the funds necessary to just like get after it.
Gotcha.
I think you're so right, Wesley, going back to what you said a second ago, that if you're willing to do a trade and learn it and dive right into it. And I really like what you said before about how when you get good at something and when you start doing something more, that's when you become passionate about it. I think so many people are looking for this thing they're passionate about. Like I like to read books, so I want to be a publisher, or I like to do this. And it's not just about what you like, but it's about what you become good at. And so getting good at something makes you passionate about it. And then you fulfill the gap, and that's how you become successful, and tying it into entrepreneurial or plumbing or HVAC. Like you said, I think people for some reason nowadays are looking down on that. Like it's this thing that they shouldn't do, or I'm going to go to college and get a major in South England literature so I can read 10 different books and get this degree that means nothing. But I'm not going to go be a plumber and start a business and maybe make a multi-million-dollar plumbing business. So
yeah, which is fairly easy. And then the bar is so low too when it comes to like trades that if you just like go up on time and like do what you say you're going to do, that puts you ahead of like probably the majority of people that are in those trades. You know, just talking to friends that are contractors and that type of thing. It's so hard to find, you know, good, reliable people. And then there's such a shortage that it kind of, it's a supply demand thing that they have. That's why I said it's good to like partner up with some entrepreneurial minded people too, to like figure out the time management and then the business side of the house versus like just the skills, because a lot of times that can be your downfall. It's like you have the skills necessary, but then like you don't manage your time or your expenses or whatever it may be. And so you need that other piece of the puzzle as well.
Yeah, I live in a small town in South Carolina, and especially at church, I just have a lot of conversations with older gentlemen, and they're all looking for people to basically just hand their business down to, and they can't even find someone who's willing to do it. They're willing to hand over this business they built for 40 years to someone that they're going to train, and no one's willing to do it. And so, I mean, I just think that's mind-boggling.
Yeah. And another thing too, as well, is like, you can kind of leverage the opportunities that you have available to you. Like with, I don't know much about, you know, Air Force or Marines or Navy or Coast Guard, but I know with the Army, you can, or the National Guard, if you go into a certain MOS, so like, let's say trucking, for instance, or like transportation, I would say, if you go into that, then you can, that also correlates to the civilian side of the house, to where you can get your CDL at 18 and do interstate trucking at 18 versus 21, which is what you have to do as a civilian. And then, so you can like, that's just like a one for instance, right? So you can leverage that opportunity, get paid the entire time you're getting trained to do that. And then you come out and then you're more hireable because you're a vet. And then as a, you know, as a veteran, people kind of expect you to have like a higher degree of discipline, which usually equates to a higher level of pay. And if you can, you know, make good on that, where you show that you are disciplined and whatnot, it makes you super valuable. And so you can get on that, you can get on that exponential curve a lot earlier, in certain career fields. You know, aircraft mechanic would be another big one, or pilot even, So all good things to think about. And then, you know, if you're not looking to go into like wartime military stuff, you could also look at the Coast Guard. Their mission set's super cool, you know, with search and rescue and law enforcement, that type of thing. You can really jumpstart your career by doing those.
Yeah. It seems like in recent years, like the recruiting for the military has been like steadily declining. Like it's like they can't find quality people. And it's like, if they do find somebody, the process of getting in weeds them out.
Yeah.
What do you think is like the biggest contributor for that? Like the decline in applicants?
Well, I think I'm going to have a polarizing view here. I think
we love those.
I think kids are lazy and out of shape. So they can't, like, there's actually no question about it. Like, the statistics speak for themselves. The people that are mentally qualified for the job don't meet like height, weight. And that's why they're having to implement these like programs to where they help them meet the PT standards. And then the people that do meet the PT standards, then they can't pass an ASVAB, which is insane. Because it's not very hard. You need like a 30 something to qualify for a lot of MOSs, and that's not a very high score. So I think that we're just missing discipline with our young folks. And then the kids that are well informed on, or that are, you know, like performers, we should say, I think that they get just like a bad taste in their mouth from the military. It kind of carries like a negative connotation to it. So it turns them off of that. But I think they're doing some good things to like turn that around, the military, to like give it a different, show it in a different light. But yeah, I mean, it's a different day and age that we live in than like our parents, who, you know, came off some pretty big wars. You know, with like World War II, and but I feel like that influence is kind of going away, and so we're kind of looking at more modern wartime events, and you know, they can be put in a pretty negative light. So it's just a matter of where people get their information from.
Yeah, and I think to your point, you were kind of talking about how you have people that physically aren't able to meet the standard, and then you'll have the branch, whatever branch it is, will lower the standard to get more applicants.
Yeah.
I think, I don't know how you feel about this, but I feel like sometimes by even lowering the standard, you deter more people away from the military, because it's not the challenge that maybe they wanted.
Yeah, I could see that. Another issue too is when you get into it, some people are kind of given preferential treatment based on some things that that aren't necessarily, people are getting like promotions and pushed through schools and stuff, not necessarily based on their works and ability level, but based on like who they are. And so that's super off-putting. Not only for, you know, the folks that get pushed through, but then people that belong to those demographics that do meet the standard, they kind of, people assume that they got pushed through because they belong to that demographic. And so that's, I feel like that's a pretty tough thing. We got to figure out that it needs to go straight back to just, on merit, you know, system, to where like, these are the standards. Like, if you meet them, great. If not, sorry, it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter who you are. It is what it is. So,
and it almost has to be like a blind testing somehow. There has to be some way to remove any type of indicators.
They're trying to do that now.
Yeah, and I think going back to what you were saying, even in terms of the youth coming up, Tim Kennedy talks about it all the time, about how just the applicant pool is so small now because the amount of obesity that stems through like the 16 to 18 year old range, and how you can't even get in because you're not even in the available weight class. And I wish I knew the percentage off the top of my head, but it's like an exponential percentage. And so the only way that I can think about to fix that, and it sounds crazy, is like that starts with PE class at school. Like if we make that even just like an actual workout instead of doing bowling in physical education, like does that just set us up to have a bigger applicant pool and then give us more availability to bring people in? Oh, I'm curious what you guys think about that.
I mean, 100%. I think that there's a very big problem with our education system and the way that it currently exists. And I mean, I think that you know, physical education is definitely important. It's certainly a good thing to do, but I think long term we need to kind of go back to the drawing board on our educational system. And there's some people that I follow and like really like that have some good ideas. And if we could implement that on a larger scale, I think we'd be better off for it. But it's such a giant thing that encompasses so many people that it's so difficult to like make changes. Because you have the people that are in place are kind of used to doing it one way, and to change all that for a large group of people is a monumental task for sure.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'm going to shift gears a little bit here. I'm curious to hear a little bit about, so like you were in the National Guard, and I can't remember if we talked before, if you were married while you were in the National Guard still, or you said you were.
Yeah.
So how did that all pan out? Like, how did y'all meet? And then how did you go about proposing and all that?
Well, I mean, that all happened before. So on the proposal side, I can dive right into that one. That one's, some people find that story interesting. Chastity, my wife, is very into ballroom dancing, and she trained quite a bit and did like competitions and, you know, showcases and stuff like that. And so she had this, she always did a showcase twice a year. And so I got with her instructor without her knowing, and learned the dance on my lunch breaks at work for like 8 months. And then day of the showcase, I came out on the stage kind of halfway and, you know, kind of off guard, and at the end of it, good knee, and that was that. So that was pretty fun.
Man, so you pretty much, did you know how to dance before that?
No.
So basically, I guess I'm assuming y'all had known each other for a little while, and you were like, she's the one, so I'm going to spend 8 months learning this dance just to pop the question.
Yep.
That's dedication, dude. That's awesome.
Wesley, when it comes down to, when it comes down to what you were looking for in a wife, what would you say to any young man listening to this who is maybe single or debating on if he thinks the girl he's dating is the one? What are some qualities that you saw in your wife that you think would make not only a good wife, but a good mother to your kids now?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you know, everybody's probably gonna be a little bit different with this. Find somebody that you can get along with just like on a friend's level, that you share common interests, you like doing, you know, similar things, and like you just generally like being around each other. I think in the dating world especially, we can draw a little bit too much, we maybe put like a little bit too much weight on physical appearances and attraction. So I think it's good to know, like, to spend time just like as friends with the person that you end up marrying, obviously you want them to be, you want to be attracted to them as well. But I think if you are able to share like that just super core friendship and have it be somebody that, you know, you would like just hanging out with all the time, no matter what, then like you're pretty much setting yourself up for success there. And yeah. And then, you know, don't give too much weight to what other people say, about the person that you choose. You know, you need to like follow your own heart and, prayer about it. And I feel like a lot of people can kind of settle for somebody that they think that their parents want them to be. And anyway, I think that it's good to, you know, give some weight to it, but at the same time, you know, just, you know, if this is the person for you, it's the person for you. And if somebody has a, you know, a negative opinion of them because of maybe their back upbringing or, you know, social class or who knows, they can be so many different factors. They're an athlete, not an artist, or I don't know. It could be a bunch of different crazy reasons, but, you know, trust your gut on it.
Gotcha. So like, obviously.
Oh, and go through four seasons with that person. Go through four seasons with that person before you.
I like that. I've never heard it put like that. So you proposed, you got married, and then I guess anytime in between then, what would you say is the biggest lesson that you've learned? And it could be from a failure, but the biggest lesson you've learned about being a good husband?
I think it's setting aside your own wants and needs for the, like the two of you, but it doesn't really feel that way. Like you may feel that way in like the moment when you have to like say no to something, but then like the result of that ends up, you know, tenfold better. And other learning moments with, I think you also need to acknowledge that, like, if your spouse, girlfriend has a feedback for you, no matter how that feedback is delivered, they think it to be true in their mind. And so if you can come at it that way, that like what their entire life has set them up to like have this opinion, you know, try to just acknowledge that, even though you may disagree, and, you know, try to see where they're coming from. And then at some point you might just have to like respectfully like disagree. But I think if you can, you know, seek understanding from somebody's viewpoint, I think this is not just true with, you know, your spouse, but with other people too. And you can like really listen and seek to understand somebody, I think that everybody's better because of that.
Yeah.
That's spot on. I think that's perfect. And just taking the time to be patient and listen to is something that I think so many men and husbands aren't willing to do. And so for you to put that out as one of your number one lessons learned, I think is pretty big. Let's flip gears now into fatherhood and being the father of not only one child to start, but having twins as your firstborn. Tell us about that journey and correct me if I'm wrong. Are y'all just driving around so the twins can sleep right now? Is that what y'all are
doing? Yeah. They're supposed to be napping, but we're on vacation and they're not wanting to nap in the new environment. So they're in the car and they're napping right now.
Did you ever think that that'd be you when you were getting pulled over at 16 on your bike? Did you think you'd be driving twins around trying to get them to nap?
You know, I'll be honest with you. Like when we got together, I think both of us were on the same page that we didn't necessarily, you know, we weren't planning to have children, but then, you know, as we grew together as a couple, like we really wanted to bring kids into the world and raise them together. And I'm super, super blessed to have my wife and as supportive as she is. and she makes big sacrifices for our family.
That's awesome.
With wow. with it comes to the children, and then I think that she really appreciates everything that you do. We make it happen.
It's funny how God works too, that you guys were even considering not having children and just being married, and then God says, you know what, I'm gonna give you two to start off here, not just one. You guys can jump right on. Yeah. In.
That's right. And then I will tell you that like your motivations in life definitely change after you have children. So, you know, before it's kind of like, what do you want? And then now it's kind of like, how do I pave the path for them so that they have the best chance of success possible? And so, you know, in starting my podcast, the shameless plug here, the Inspired Father podcast, is trying to learn from other men, fathers on successes and failures that they've had or perceive that they had with their children. You know, because with two, like, you don't get to test it out on the first one and then fix it with the second one. Like, you got to get it right from day one. And, you know, there is also not necessarily, like, the right way. But, you know, I want to seek to be the best that I can be. And I don't remember who said it, but success leaves clues. And, you know, if you just reach out, people will be happy to share those things with you. So,
what would you say?
Anyway,
what would you say is the biggest threat now in fatherhood? What would you say the biggest threat facing fathers today is?
Biggest threat,
whether personal or, you know, society imposed.
I think the biggest one that I struggle with is just distraction. And I'm pretty aware of it, but at the same time, you know, not only with your kids, but like if you're distracted around your spouse, then you don't give your spouse the attention and what they need. And then, you know, it kind of snowballs and that will at some point translate over to your children. So just being present, I think, is a big one. And then I think also, you know, maintaining your house and like pushing for what you want for want out of and for your children. You know, biblically speaking, you know, it doesn't say bad things about disciplining your children. Like, it only speaks good things about your children. And then scripture written to children also says, you know, you know, honor your father and mother. And I think that you absolutely should do that unless you like, you have bad parents. You know, and they're like maybe involved in some sort of like illegal activity or, you know, something crazy like that. But if you have like genuine parents that like care about you, then you should definitely try to like honor your father and mother, be obedient. Because at the end of the day, are they going to, they're probably trying to set you up for success, not failure, right? So,
yeah.
All that to be said, I think we should do our best to pass down wisdom to our children.
Wow.
And then I don't know exactly who your target audience is either, but like if you have an older demographic too, I think that a lot of weight is put on children that don't leave the home and that they're considered to be like non-starters and that type of a thing. And I think that that does exist, but I think if you carry a negative weight from it in your own head as a parent, then that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy towards the child. And I think that it should actually be considered like an opportunity to pass down wisdom to your children. Because you don't have the mental capacity, like in your teenage years, to download some of the wisdom that your parents might have. And if you find yourself like in your parents' home, you know, into your 20s or I mean, even third, it also can allow you to kind of like jumpstart your child's success or journey towards success versus, you know, if you leave the home at 18 and then all of a sudden, like, you're forced to pay for rent and groceries and all that, makes it hard to really like focus on your education and developing the skills that you need to when you're trying to like figure out how to survive as an adult, as well as like develop these skills. Whereas if you can kind of take some of that pressure off, I think that that's a big opportunity. However, I will say that like if a child just decides to like get married, I think that they should certainly be leaving their parents' home and starting one of their own with their spouse. So that is one caveat there. I don't think that spouses or that a married child should be living at home.
That's spot on.
Well, so, you know, years ago, like during World War II and that whole age, and that generation that came out of that, I think a lot of the threats facing men at that time were a lot different than today. What would you say is the biggest threat facing men in modern time? Or, you know, I would just say
men or their children.
Let's start with men and then we can go into children.
Okay. I don't remember who said this, but I think our goal as a man is to be useful. And that if you are useful, then you will have a lot of self-confidence and a lot of these things will kind of fall into place. But if you kind of pigeonhole yourself to where like you're only good at one thing and you have to rely on other people for everything, you might feel a little bit a lack of confidence and ability to like stand up for things. But if you know that you're a little bit more self-sufficient, then you can stand up, you can take a stance on things and, you know, have it not weigh on you that it's going to like hurt your well-being. And then two, just the sense of, you know, pride that you get in like being able to fix problems for people, I think is a big one. So, you know, I think the biggest enemy to men these days, I guess, is that you need to like find that one thing to be like super really good at. I think you should try a lot of things and, you know, get a basic understanding out of a lot of different things to become like useful as a human being, father, husband, leader. And so that way, like when somebody has a problem, they can come to you and you can fix it. And there's a lot that comes out of that.
Gotcha. Okay. And what about children real quick?
What's I think losing track of like who's influencing your children.
Ooh,
that's spot on.
So kind of like who you allow into your, I guess your home.
And it's not necessarily like a person, but you know, it's also like mediums by which they can be reached.
Yeah, we talked about that a lot a couple episodes ago, talking about how you're not nowadays, you're not only protecting the guy on their doorstep with a gun, but you're protecting from the random YouTuber who everyone's letting their kid watch this girl on her tablet. Everyone's watching them, letting them watch whoever. And I think especially even as they get older, like when fourth, fifth, sixth grade, and they start getting influenced by their friends and what then you're protecting against not only what's coming in, but their friends are pushing things and all that. And, and there's a lot more to watch out for nowadays than back in the day.
Yeah, 100%. I agree with that.
Well, Wesley, we're about to wrap it up here in just a minute. I wanted to ask you two quick questions and whatever Jake has left for you. Wholesale lobster.
Send it.
Wholesale lobster. Let's get into that. What is that?
So my wife worked as a traveling nurse for a few years after I stopped doing the car sales thing. And we went to Maine and I needed a job. So I found this job on Craigslist. And anyway, it was wild. But anyway, I worked on an island between Portsmouth, New Hampshire and Kittery, Maine. called Badger's Island. And what we would do is we would sell bait to lobstermen in the morning, like 50-gallon drums of like hoagie, skate, herring, just like some nasty stuff. And then cowhide as well. And then in the afternoon, the lobstermen would bring their catch in and we would grade it and pay them. And it's just a wild time, man. That is a interesting group of people.
That's pretty cool. I was curious about that.
Yeah.
So my last question is, we've talked about a lot and I know there's.
Man, I did get the opportunity to go out on a boat a couple.
Sorry, we were cutting out a little bit. Can you hear me?
No worries. Yep.
Yeah,
I got him now.
I was going to say, my last question, we've talked about a lot, and we could probably have four other podcasts still talking about all the life experiences that you've had. What would you say, or I would ask it this way, how have you drawn on your career experiences to become a better dad? So whether that's being a pilot, National Guard, or almost getting arrested by the cops, you know, what would you say you've drawn from to really fine tune your tools as a dad?
I think that being open to, there's a quote. So somebody I'm going to butcher this thing bad, but every man and woman, I should say, has something that they're really good at. And it's my job to kind of like seek that out and to learn from other people's experience. And so in doing different, you know, careers and being associated with different people, I think that we just need to be open and willing to receiving knowledge from other people and like seeking out wisdom from those who've kind of been down the path before you. And then it can also be like learning from those people's failures as well. So that you don't have to necessarily repeat those mistakes. I think that's a big one. And that's kind of what I'm trying to do with the podcast and my own, as far as fatherhood is concerned, is just seek out the wisdom from those who've, you know, who are on that path as well. And doing so many different things in my life has allowed me to be comfortable with an ever-changing environment. And when you have children, especially in like these first few years, like the environment is definitely changing. And, you know, when you're dealing with like lack of sleep and that type of thing, having that experience of, you know, suffering, whether it's, you know, in sports or military training or anything like that, just knowing that like you can get through tough times or job changes or anything like that, just knowing you can get through tough times, and that usually what comes out on the better end is a better version of you, and then you end up having a lot of fun along the way.
That's really good, man.
That's awesome. Yeah, we don't want to take up any more of your time, but my last question is, I want you to go ahead and plug your pod, unshamelessly plug your pod, tell the listeners where they can find it. Just go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's the Inspired Father podcast, and it's on anywhere that you can consume podcasts, YouTube, Spotify, Apple, all of the different places. And then it's just me interviewing other dads. And figure out what makes them inspirational.
That's cool.
And it's, you know, again, I got young twins, so I want to kind of avoid any mistakes that I can and be the best that I can be and seek out that wisdom from other fathers.
That's awesome. Yeah. Other than that, we appreciate you being here, Wesley. I know that, it's not easy for everyone to get time to do stuff like this. So we really appreciate it, especially on your vacation and during your twins nap time. So
yeah,
that is a few good men.
Awesome. Thanks guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you, man.
Appreciate you, Wesley.